So I want to tell you a little bit about some of the upcoming programs of the joint ACM IEEE seminar series. Next month, we'll be meeting in the new Media Lab building, the sixth floor auditorium of a new building on the corner of Ames Street and Amherst Street. Sandy Pentland, who's the head of the Human Dynamics Group at the Media Lab, is going to talk about how increased use of sensors are going to transform the internet into a new reality net. And his group was the group who won the DARPA contest for some of his graduate students to use the internet to locate red balloons spread throughout the country. So if you come next month, maybe you'll learn how they did that and learn of other ways people can use the internet to integrate sensors into decision-making and lots of other things. Then in May, we're going to be meeting in the Broad Institute Auditorium. Bang Wong, who designed the DNA atrium for the Broad Institute, among other things, is going to talk about visualizing scientific data. And we'll talk about different ways to portray data for different purposes, both for the lay public and for data analysis for scientific purposes. And then in June, we're going to be meeting out in Waltham again at the IBM Innovation Center. Bruce Douglas, who's a senior consultant for Rational, will talk about designing real-time programming systems. So those are the upcoming meetings. Next month we'll be meeting April 29th. I think that's the fourth Thursday rather than the third one. And then in May we're going to be meeting the second Thursday instead of the third Thursday in order to avoid MIT finals. And the MIT Biological Engineering Student Group is a co-sponsor in deference to their exam for meeting one week earlier that week. Tonight is, I guess, one of a series of talks related to database management system we've been having over the past few months. Jim Starkey, who some of you may know either from Datatree and Interbase or some of his other work related to MySQL-like products, I think MySQL community, is going to be talking about what I think may be one of the new directions in database management, how database management systems will be adjusting to cloud computing, cheaper mainframe memory, and the need to scale for large amounts of data. And Jim is one of the biggest innovators in the database field. Founder of several successful products and a couple of successful companies, and started up a new company recently called NimbusDB. And with that, Jim will tell you more about that, where it's going, and possibly where the future of database management is going.
I'd like to start by saying how pleased I was to be invited to give a talk here. This is quite an honor. When I first got the invitation by email, I did a little checking to see if this was a fake or somebody was just trying to pull my chain. In fact, I gave another talk to this organization, I think the same seminar series about 25 years ago, and I'm pleased to see that most of the people here are over 25. But at that time, they gave me a topic that they wanted to talk on, and I believe, if I remember correctly, it was the taxonomy of fourth generation languages. And it was a talk so dull that at the end of the talk, the audience had to wake me up. My personal goal tonight is to change the way you think about database systems. I'm going to challenge you. I'm going to kick some sacred cows. And let's see where it goes. Given the size of the group, I think I'm going to have to ask for questions at the end rather than interactive. That's the way I prefer to do things. So if you desperately need to ask a question, write it down on a piece of paper and try and remember. Maybe you'll find something even more serious to have to call me on. I'm going to be talking on special relativity and the problem of database scalability. And what do they have to do with each other? Well, essentially nothing, except from a history of science perspective, the problems they address and the solutions that result from a change in theory. So here's roughly what I'm going to do. We're going to talk about what the problem is. We're going to just discuss some jargon. Maybe you know this stuff. We're going to talk a little bit about some physics, a little theory, database theory, and then talk about NimbusDB and where I'm going with this. The problem that we're here to solve, worry about, come up with a solution to understand, is that database systems scale badly beyond a single computer. The classical solutions, if you need more capacity than you can get on a single computer, is either get a bigger computer or to set up a database federation so we have a bunch of independent, more or less independent databases, you know, one handling a partition from A through C and then D through G and so on and so forth, and then connected with middleware and a two-phase commit. Not very elegant, not terribly satisfying. It works. The other way to phrase the problem is how do we get more oomph for more bucks? We want to get more than we can get out of a single computer. Personally, I like the idea of bunches of cheap computers rather than a single expensive computer. Now, traditionally in talks like this, I should start with some graphs about memory sizes going like that from the time. I used to work on the data computer project at CCA over at Tech Square. It was a PDP-10. It started out as 80K and went to 128. Those were 36-bit words, so it wasn't all that small. The ARPANET had 46 nodes on it. The world has changed since then. So memory sizes have gotten enormously larger. The number of cycles available has gone near infinite. The size of disks have gone huge. The speed of networks has gone through the ceiling. And disk technology is kind of going like this. And if you look at disk capacity, disk performance per CPU cycle, it goes like this. And if you look at disk performance for memory speed, it goes like this. And if you look at disk performance versus memory size, it goes like that. So the problem we really have is disks. We got to get database systems out of disks. That's problem one. Problem two is we've got to figure out how to use a network of computers to solve a single problem rather than depending on larger and larger computers. Okay, some glossary. Probably all of you know all of this. I'm going to put my own slant on it. Okay, we're talking a lot about transactions. Is there anyone here who does not know what a transaction is? Database transaction? You know about ACID? Okay, fine, great. It's atomic. It's consistent. We're going to be talking a lot about what it means to be consistent. That's one of the major themes I'm talking about. Isolated, of course, the one transaction doesn't see partial transactions. It doesn't see uncommitted data. And it's durable. You know, once it's committed, it stays there. You've heard this 100 times. Okay, consistency. What does it actually mean? We'll talk about serializability in a minute, but consistency. And it's very rarely defined, and that's really very interesting because people have been talking about database consistency for 25 or 30 years. And can you find a definition of it? Well, not exactly. Let me just give it a shot. First, in a consistent database, transactions are isolated, both read-write, which means that a transaction doesn't see dirty data from another transaction, and write-write, which means that one transaction can't overwrite data from concurrent transaction. That's just common sense. That's just software basic sanitary rules. The second is very simple. You have a series of database constraints. They're enforced. So if you have a unique key, it better be unique. If you've got a referential integrity relationship, a foreign key, primary key, that's enforced. You want to have other rules? Go right ahead. You define what consistency means. Build the database system, and it can enforce it. So, consistency means what you want it to mean. Basic rules, transaction sanitation. Second rule, it's declarative. Serializability. We're talking a lot about this. Serializable system, database system, is where you take a bunch of concurrent transactions, and they have the effect as if they were ordered, that they were executed one by one, serially. with no overlap at all. So it says that if you are a serializable system, you behave as if you weren't a concurrent system at all, though you might get some concurrency out of it. From approximately the dawn of time, serializable has been considered to be equivalent to consistent. And if you read the literature or go to a lecture, except for this one, you'll see them used essentially interchangeably. And I think that's a mistake. And I'm going to try and demonstrate that. Okay, when I say the word node, I don't use the word computer or server. Those are kind of ambiguous. I'm going to say node. Node on a network. It's a computer. It's running a process, an operating system. Nothing, just straight terminology. And I can talk about elasticity. I mean, everybody who's heard of cloud computing knows about elasticity. It means you've got a functional system. If you want to make it faster, you can plug another computer into it, and it goes faster. Simple, straightforward, harder to do than it is to talk about. The other side of elasticity is that if you decide you want to use a computer for something else, you can yank it out, or if the computer catches on fire, or whatever happened goes wrong, that whatever the system is, it keeps on going. It might go a little bit slower, but it doesn't go belly up. So elasticity grow and shrink with the number of computers as demand and resources allow. Okay, a little bit of superficial physics. Isaac Newton, I assume he's still taught in school. He not only invented the calculus, he invented a bunch of laws of mechanics. The first law of mechanics is that a body at rest stays at rest. Now, this is inertia, but just think about it. I mean, you take a fourth grader now at a decent school, you say a body at rest, he says, what's that mean? I mean, your body isn't at rest, it's rest relative to something else. Well, in Newton's perspective, there's a universal reference frame. Of course, it's the Earth. And a body is moving relative to the Earth, or it's stationary relative to the Earth. I mean, this is an absolute thing. And this was recognized by Newton, and it tied into his own personal theology. On the other hand, I think any time you get religion and science mixed, each one suffers. So maybe that was a mistake. But very much, physics for 200 years just assumed that there was a universal reference frame, and you could talk about something was moving or something that was stationary. A couple hundred years later, physics got a little bit more sophisticated, people recognized that light had all the properties of a wave. That's great. Everybody knows what waves are. Lights have property of waves. Problem is that waves have to propagate in a medium, or at least they thought they did. And sometime in the early 19th century, the concept of luminiferous ether was invented. Now, that is the medium for which light moves. And everybody knew there was a vacuum in space, but we had to have something, a medium, to be able to do light propagation. Luminiferous is from as luminous light, and ether, which I have recently learned, is Greek for blue sky, which I guess is the absolute absence of cloud computing. Now, once we've invented ether, and you use that as the medium for the propagation of light, you come to the immediate conclusion that the speed of light is relative to the ether, because it's propagating through it. I mean, if you have a stream of water and a wave going down the stream, that the wave is going faster on shore because the medium itself is moving. And this was widely accepted for the better part of a century, and just became a standard part of physics. This is one of these really dangerous things in science that everybody knows. Something I've kind of learned over a long period of time is that if everybody knows something, in fact, it's probably false. So let's fast forward from Mr. Newton to around 1880, and Michelson and Morley, and you've all heard about them. they did a series of experiments, and they had a number, there were a number of things which were absolutely extraordinary about their experiments. The first is that Morley, who was a graduate student, got equal billing with his professor. I mean, just think about that. There might be another instance in the history of science, but I don't know. What Michelson and Morley set out to investigate was not the presence of luminous ether, but to test which of the theories about the effect of the Earth traveling through the ether was correct. Was there a slipstream in the ether caused by the passage of the mass of the Earth? So they set out to do some measurements between different seasons, and they measured and they measured, and they came back and said, we don't see anything here. We don't see a difference. We're trying to test two theories, and we're not getting anywhere on either of them, let alone a difference between the two. And they spent 5 or 6 years refining their instruments, getting them more and more precise. When all was said and done, all they could say is, we can't find any difference in the speed of light, no matter how we measure it. If there's ether out there, somebody else is going to have to come up with a reason why we don't see it. In 1905, other people working on the problem, Einstein wasn't the first, but he put it together very elegantly. Einstein took the idea that the speed of light is a constant. He took the idea that the laws of physics have to be the same every place in the universe. And came up and published a paper in 1905 called Special Relativity. It was a 50-page paper, no footnotes, no experimental data, and just putting together known information, known theories about what was going on. And one thing, you know, that he thought about was, okay, we have two bodies that are moving at a very rapid speed, and the speed of light, light is leaving one, it's going to the other one. Each one sees the same speed of light. You know, this is going to be the red shift or the blue shift that the astronomers have been seeing. And then, if you think about that a little bit more, it says if you take a meter stick and you measure how long it is in wavelengths of your light, and that's going to be the same from all observers, even though the frequency of the light is going to change, the wavelength of the light is going to change, well, the length of that meter stick is going to appear different from different observers traveling at different speeds. And you take it one step further. Time has to be a little bit different, too. I mean, this is just trying to make the stuff work. So a mathematician named Lorenz had come up with some transformations about the same time Einstein applied them. We've got a little bit of matrix arithmetic, and you can take an X, Y, Z and time coordinate, map it into another reference frame, figure out what the two guys are going to see. Readily accepted, very rapidly became, you know, the basis of modern physics. And it was just looking at a concept that had been widely accepted, rejecting it, coming up with a theory that actually works. So returning to database. Serializability. Good idea or bad habit? Now, is this an important concept that's critical to database systems, or is this a fuzzy idea that really hasn't been thought through very well? I don't think anyone's going to disagree, though my wife will slightly, that serializability isn't a sufficient condition for consistency. If you have a correct transaction and you run one at a time, then you're going to have a consistent database. Who's going to argue with that? Nobody. Except maybe my wife. Or maybe me. The question is, and this is the critical question, is it a necessary condition for consistency? If it isn't, we've got a problem, because it's extremely expensive to enforce. That you spend a great deal more time enforcing serializability than you actually spent enforcing consistency. And because the way the technology to enforce serializability is loathsome in terms of practicality of database systems. Primarily done with record locking. You block records as you see them. If you write them, you get a write lock. If you just read them, you get a read lock. Therefore, two transactions will naturally serialize. The problem is you can't lock a record that you didn't see, so somebody stores a record and the other transaction goes back and sees a record that wasn't there before. These are called phantoms. The way you get rid of phantoms is you start have to locking all of the paths through access to a table, and one of those is you have to lock a mythical and a file pointer. So if you're doing a sequential scan of a table, somebody can't store a record after you've done a sequential scan, or if you started a sequential scan, and this means that if anybody counts the number of employees, you've locked up the entire employee database. So what most database systems, I would say virtually all commercial database systems do, is they have a serializable mode for the purpose of getting a check mark on the evaluation, and then they start backing off on relaxed transaction modes, and the first thing they do is say, we're going to have read committed. We can see records that are committed by other transactions, and they won't show, they'll show up as phantoms, but you can deal with that. Well, this is completely useless. It's not serializable, and it's not good for anything. But you get all the expense of serialization, even if you don't get whatever benefit there might be. But let's make this observation. If you're serializable, it means that for every set of concurrent transactions, that you have an order in which they can operate, for which you get a consistent result, one at a time. Now, look at this. If you're starting a transaction, running it, committing it, then starting the next transaction, running it and committing it, it means that every single point that you have a single absolute state of your database system. Every point there is a single definitive state of that database system. Now, if you take the contrapositive of that, it says if you have a system that's actually being parallel and you don't have a single definitive state, it means it can't be serializable. So you can pretty much prove, just based on serializability, that if you have a serializable database, it'll never scale. You can run on a single computer, run it over a network, it's not going to work very well. And this agrees very, very well with the empirical results of database products on the market. The vast majority of database systems run on single nodes. There are cluster databases like Oracle Rack. Did one myself at DEC called RDB Elan. They run on VAX clusters. They get a little bit better, but they basically treat a cluster like a single machine. They don't go very far. They don't scale very well, and it turns out that they need a lot of very expensive communication stuff and a distributed lock manager to work at all. So here we have a concept that actually isn't required for consistency, that it has retarded the development of highly parallel database systems. And gosh, we have now the universal reference frame, that there is an absolute reference frame. I guess God can see it. That's definitive. Okay. A couple of thoughts on time, particularly as it applies to distributed database systems. First is time is a sequence of events. It's not just a clock. I mean, if you've got two nodes running, one in Alpha Centauri and one on Earth, there's a big lag between them, and things are happening in Alpha Centauri and things are happening on Earth, and trying to get them intermeshed to figure out what happened before what other is completely pointless. Because they're isolated. As Einstein points out, it's not, everything is bounded by the speed of light. Nothing can exceed the speed of light. There is a cost to communication. It has nothing to do with how fast your wire is. It has nothing to do with how thin your protocol stacks are. Communication takes latency. And therefore, you have two nodes that are operating over a network, whether they're plugged into the same backplane, they're separated by some latency. Each one is seeing events. Each one sees events on the other one. You can't talk about the idea of same time or simultaneously. Things just happen in different orders from different perspectives. It's not a bug. That's the way it has to be. Logic doesn't work if you do it any other way. Question is, deal with it. We can execute computers in lockstep. We can have a distributed lock manager, so things go ding, 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 ding. And the problem with that is we don't get any benefit from it, at least not worth the cost. Okay. An alternative to record locking, which is proving to be very, very interesting in this environment, and I have to say, having come up with it in the first place, I am attached to it. But multi-version concurrency control, which is an alternative to serialization. And for those of you who aren't familiar with it, you know, the basic idea is that rather than the database system keeping one state of a record, if a transaction comes in and modifies that record, it leaves the old version in place and creates a new version pointing to the old one. So you have a chain of versions. Each one is tagged with a transaction identification of the transaction who created it. And when a transaction is running, it scurries through the version and finds the version consistent with the time the transaction started. The database system underneath sees updates. The transaction does not. The transaction sees an absolutely stable view of the database. It doesn't see concurrent changes. And it works very nicely. I came up with this when I was at DAC. The problem was, it was data tree. I'm trying to use a transactional database system. In this case, the CODASIL database system, which have almost all died, thank God. But a problem was, if somebody started to do something and then went off to lunch, everyone else was locked out because the database was locked up. So the question is, you know, how do you deal with this? And I was driving down Route 3 looking at a new house and I said, that's how you do it. Keep the versions. And you see a stable view of the database. And it does two things. Multi-version concurrency control both gives you read-write conflicts, so you don't see concurrent updates. The database system sees them underneath the sheets, but the transaction doesn't. The second is it can detect and handle the case where a transaction is trying to modify an old version of a record which isn't current. I mean, it recognizes it immediately. This isn't the head record. And you can do one of two things. You can either return an error to the user saying, I'm sorry, there's an update conflict, you know, figure out what to do next. The slightly smarter thing to do is to wait for the transaction to complete. And if it rolls back, then there's no problem. And if it commits, then you tell the user there's a problem. The reason that you want to wait is to avoid life lock, because what he's going to do, if he wants to update the balance on a checking account that somebody else is updating, he's going to come back and run into the same conflict a second time. So to avoid life lock, you might want to wait, but that's a database system option. Okay, time to talk about NimbusDB. NimbusDB is an elastic, ACID, SQL-based relational database. This is Jim's alternative to NoSQL. The difference is being that it is SQL. It's SQL-based. It's a relational model, actually. It has semantic extensions. It's completely ACID. It's multi-node. It takes at least two to run a Nimbus database, and it's happier with more. It's happy so many won't feed into it. Nimbus is almost a complete total break with database implementation in the past. Couple modest goals. Elastic, scalable, ACID RDMS. This is what, if you pick up any trade rag, you will read that you can't do. Designed for very high performance sitting in a data center context. You've got a gigabit Ethernet backplane, or, you know, if you're really lucky, you've got a 10 gig backplane. Nimbus is designed to, under most conditions, to run as an in-memory database. It runs with the performance of an in-memory database, although not everything has to be in memory. Because we don't want the limitations of an in-memory database. And second, and this is fairly radical, is a geographically dispersed database system. The example I like to use, and I don't think it's realistic, but let's use it anyway, and that is your bank. You've got branches in New York and you've got branches in Tokyo. You want to have a database system with a bunch of nodes in New York and a bunch of nodes in Tokyo and a couple nodes in a bunker under the state of Nebraska in case something really goes wrong. And you want to have this work as a single database system. Now, how do you do that? I think you've got an architecture that will handle that. You're going to give up a little bit of performance, not necessarily in transaction throughput, but there's going to be some latency that you're going to have to do to have to prepare for the ultimate disaster if it occurs. If you don't care about the disaster, then you don't have to pay the latency. So we're going to have geographic distributed database. We also want to have a system that's software fault tolerant. Everybody here writes bug-free code. I haven't managed that yet. And occasionally the stuff goes belly up. But when a Nimbus node goes belly up, you want the database system to continue and the transactions to restart someplace else to be kind of a non-entity. Life goes on. Somebody fixes it, reboots it, starts it up, and goes back to the same throughput capacity you had before. Then we want something that's hardware fault tolerant. Machines fail, they catch on fire, people trip over them, all of these things. I haven't tripped over mine yet. So we want to be able to handle hardware fault tolerance. And the one I really like is geological fault tolerant, is what do you do when California slides into the Pacific Ocean? There was somebody at Database Day who had a really cool slide, an animated slide of California sliding into the ocean. And I wish I had that. So software fault tolerant, hardware fault tolerant, geological fault tolerant, and the second version, human fault tolerant. And maybe we'll talk about that later. Some of the less modest goals is essentially zero administration. Somebody's going to have to design the database, figuring out what the table should be and where the keys and all that kind of stuff. I'm not worrying about that. But running the database system, worrying about where the data should be, worrying about partitioning, worrying about charting, worrying about the communication networks, figuring out what should be redundant where, we don't have any of that. We want that to be completely automatic. Figure that machines are better at tuning the machines than people are. Besides, this dynamics is going to change so fast that people couldn't keep up with it anyway. So we want to have zero administration. Lifelong ambition to put DBAs out of work. If any of you are planning to be DBAs, I'm gunning for you. Dynamic and completely self-tuning. Machines, they're cheap, they're extraordinarily fast, the stuff is complex. Let the machines do it, don't have the people do it. Having somebody paid $150,000 a year to tune a $1,200 machine is kind of a lose. Really, it is. Next, multi-tenant. Read someplace that large enterprises, have upwards of 10,000 internal database systems. Most of them with two users, but some are really big. And that's a lot of database systems to manage, a lot of database systems to administer, a lot of things to worry about, backups and this and that and software upgrades. What makes a great deal more sense is to have a nice, big, fat, take 1,000 nodes and we'll run 10,000 database systems on it. Most of them aren't doing anything at all, so they don't take up any resources. And you'll have two guys managing it, and they can spend most of their time playing with their Facebook page. So that's what multi-tenancy is all about. And finally, and this is to keep Barry, my CEO, happy, it's up for and in the cloud. We all know about cloud computing. What cloud computing needs is a database system that both scales, that it's completely available, and can handle the management of volatile data between various instances of the application running in the network. It's a piece of the cloud stack that's missing. Okay. Something I've kind of learned is one of the things you realize that causes you to realize that you're a pioneer is when you run into something that doesn't have a name. And this is one we invented ourselves. And that's a Chorus. That's the nodes that instantiate a database system. And Chorus works out very well because you can talk about the minimum system, which is a duet, which is one archive node, one transactional node. You can talk about a quartet, which is a completely redundant system with two archive nodes and two transaction nodes. And you can talk about preaching to the choir, and there's a whole lot of nonsense you can do. So glossary, Chorus, set of computers that instantiate a database. They can be doing other things too. They don't have to be dedicated to it. It's just a process that's running there. Okay. Here's the big departure of Nimbus from the previous world. Traditional way of building a database system is you start with a disk file. You break it into pages, you read and write pages. You put a lock manager on it to synchronize it, you put in a cache, memory's cheaper. No, we're not doing it that way at all. This database is composed of distributed objects called atoms. The reason I decided to call them atoms is that when I came up with some of these ideas, I was working for MySQL, and the people there really don't like objects. And figured if I could try and sell this thing and have to call them something else. But actually, atoms is a pretty good name for them. Because atoms, they have structure on the inside, but you can't see the structure from outside of the atom. They're objects. An atom, just, you know, to correlate you mentally, is their size to be about 50K when serialized. They're kind of an arbitrary size. I don't know if that's the right size or not. The bigger they are, the more expensive they are to slop around. The smaller they are, the more of them you have to slop around. What's the happy medium? I don't know. We'll figure this out in a year or two. We can do some performance measurement, but it's a soft number. An atom can have really three different existences. It can be serialized on a disk someplace if nobody cares about it. It can be deserialized in memory on a node. Or it can be serialized and sent over the network to another node who wants it. And then the neat thing about atoms is that all of the instances of an atom within a chorus know about each other and they replicate to each other on a peer-to-peer basis. So if you make a change to one atom, he says all of his friends, hey, I've been changed, and everybody else within the communication delta will hear about that change. So an atom can reside any number of nodes within a chorus. They can reside in every single node, and there come some atoms that do that reside in every single node. There are a lot of atoms that are going to sit and rot on the disk because nobody cares about what the bestseller was in 1957. And there are other atoms that are going to be some places and not other places. So they replicate peer-to-peer. And finally, every atom in a chorus, every active atom in a chorus has a chairman. A non-executive chairman, right out of Monty Python. Almost every atom has a couple things that need to be serialized for some reason, for consistency. And if something needs to be serialized, you go to the chairman and ask whether this is okay, and the chairman will say yeah or no. The chairman is responsible for enforcing consistency. Now, it's deterministic which node is chairman for any given node. Everybody understands it, and there's a deterministic line of succession. So if the chairman disappears, everybody knows who the next chairman is. So that all works very, very nicely. But that's important to the consistency model. Examples of atoms. There's a transaction manager. Everyone has got a transaction manager, except for maybe the archive nodes. And they start and end transactions. So the guys who start transaction give them an ID, says, okay, this one's done. And of course, they all chat among themselves, so they know what's going on, plus or minus network latency. There's a table atom, which keeps the metadata about the table and keeps pointers to other atoms or IDs of other atoms that actually have the data. Relatively stable, except when you're doing data definition sort of stuff, in which case it's a little bit volatile. There's a data atom, which actually stores data. You know, from time to time, you forget that after all of this elegance and all of this messaging and all of the objects, you got to store the data someplace. That's in data atoms. And finally, there's a couple types of catalog atoms, which keep track of other atoms. So if you need something, you ask the catalog atom, you know, find me this, and either has a pointer to it or he'll get it for you. Okay, within a Nimbus chorus, there are two node types. There are transactional nodes that do SQL. Got a pretty much standard SQL engine in it that sits talking to the atoms underneath. And then there are archive nodes that exist to maintain a persistent copy of the data on disk. And because people get nervous when the data isn't on disk. And the advantage of having data on disk is so you don't have to keep it in memory and you can use memory for more important stuff. Because no matter how much memory you've got, you never have enough. Now the interesting thing about this is that the transactional nodes don't use disks. They're memory only. And the guys who have disks, the archive nodes, don't do SQL. So this is getting the disks as far away as you possibly can. And I'm happy with that. When I got my first batch of my Canonical server nodes, 4-core, 8-gig, 2-gigabit Ethernet, these are $1,200 servers, I did a couple measurements with Linux. And one is, and it kind of surprised me, with using, you know, a $200 switch, two really cheap Linux systems can pump 8,500 messages per second over the network without breaking the sweat for 100-byte packets. And if you just want to stream data, depending on packet size, you could easily get better than 90% of the available bandwidth on Ethernet, on gigabit Ethernet, which I find astonishing. I was kind of there when Ethernet was semi-born. I happened to be in the room when DEC decided to join with Xerox and Intel to do the 10 meg Ethernet. And that's a story maybe I'll tell you later. But when Ethernet came out, there were vast numbers of people who didn't believe it worked. There was, it'll jam. Nothing will ever happen. You can only get 70% of capacity and then the thing goes south. Well, we know that's not true anymore. Anyway, 8,500 messages per second ain't bad. The fastest disk you could possibly get your hands on can do about 200. That's pretty shocking. Disks, and they'll never catch up. They're mechanical. No mechanical thing can chase an electron. It's hopeless. Okay, NIFS-TP communication, it's all based on TCP, of course. That's nothing magic about TCP. That just happens to be what's there, and it works very well. The communication, it's fully connected. Every node talks to every other node. Everyone's got an open socket to every other node. They certainly know about each other. So it's fully connected. All the communication is asynchronous. Nobody ever sends a message and holds the line waiting for a reply. Everything is asynchronous. We send a message, and it's a link. There's a lot of stuff coming over the link, and we may wait for the reply, but we're not going to tie up the link while we're doing it. Messages are ordered. It's critically important that messages sent by node A are processed by node B in the same order that node A sent them. So messages have to be ordered, and they're batched, which is very nice because you can fit a bunch of small messages into one packet, ship the sucker off, and it makes very efficient use of the network system. It also means that you can do things that might make you choke, where a single update operation that may happen to hit three atoms, each one is to produce a tiny little update packet replication message for his companions and other systems on his peers. But these all go out in one physical packet, so it really doesn't cost anything. You're sending the same data whether you put it together. So unless you put together a very nice, elegant system without really incurring a communication cost. The measurements that I have done so far suggest that gigabit Ethernet is going to be absolutely dandy for up about 40 or 50 nodes. The thing is really very light on the bandwidth that it's using, which is kind of nice. But again, fully connected, asynchronous, ordered, and batched. Messaging, this is the problem with distributed databases and fully connected distributed databases is you tend to have an N-squared messaging problem. All right, we add another node, and now your n squared is by a factor of n larger. And you get swamped by messages, and in a relatively small number of nodes, you just drowned in a stream of messages. In Nimbus, not everybody has everything. Nodes basically choose about what atoms they want to have memory resident, and you only replicate updates to people who have memory resident. So a couple observations, and that is most data is archived. It's archival and inactive. You want to have it in case somebody cares what the bestseller was in 1957, but for God's sakes, you don't need it in a microsecond. You might be able to wait, 20 milliseconds to get it off the silly disk. but you want to have it available. So most of the data is archival and inactive. Second, a small fraction of the data is actually active, but relatively stable. Like, what was the bestseller 2 years ago? You know, who bought the theatrical version of Lord of the Rings? Like, who cares? So you have a smaller fraction, and this stuff can be shared, but there's no messaging cost because this stuff isn't changed. An even smaller fraction is volatile, but it's local. I mean, you're buying something from Amazon, and yeah, you're one node in the chorus is dealing with it, and all the other connections having to do with this customer will go back there. And yeah, they're changing a lot of stuff, but it's not going anyplace because nobody particularly cares about that customer for a variety of reasons. And it's really only when you get down to that small subset of data, which is both volatile and shared across a large number of nodes, you actually incur a large a messaging, you know, something that's approaching an N-squared messaging situation, and those are extraordinarily rare. In our example of New York and Tokyo and ATMs, most of the people in New York who are getting stuff out of ATMs are getting from their New York accounts, and most of the people in Tokyo who are getting yen out of their accounts are getting it from Japanese accounts, and the Japanese accounts will stay in memory over here, and the New York accounts will stay over here, and every once in a while, somebody from New York will go to New York, fly to Tokyo with a craving for sushi, want to get some dollars to pay off his sushi bill, and yeah, then he has to go get something, but that's the exception. So the bottom line is you really want to replicate messages to nodes that care. NimbusDB nodes are essentially autonomous. Each one makes policy decisions by itself. If a node needs an atom, he's got a table atom that references a hunk of data, he needs that hunk of data, he doesn't have it, he can choose where to get it. You know, something that a Nimbus node does is every second or so he pings everybody else and says how long and then times it takes for the reply to come back so he gets some idea of which nodes are most responsive. He doesn't care whether a node is responsive because it's overloaded, it doesn't have enough money, it happens to be VAX and ancient, it happens to be in Tokyo. Slow is slow. Talk to guys who are fast. So when it wants an atom, through a little bit of magic, it knows who in the chorus has a copy of that atom, and he's going to pick the most responsive guy who's got it, which is almost certainly going to be somebody who's nearby. And he's going to ask the transactional node in preference to asking an archive node, because archive nodes are busy doing other things like writing boring stuff to disk. If nobody's got a copy of the atom, then he goes to the archive node and says, okay, get the sucker off of disk and give it to me. So he gets it. But his first choice is to pick it over the network. This gives Nimbus a little bit of a superscalar benefit, and that is you add more machines, you have more memory, the higher the probability that a given atom is going to be sitting in memory someplace, and it goes faster rather than slower. Now, whether this offsets the additional messaging, I don't know. We'll have to measure that later. A node also chooses which atoms he wants to keep. If somebody had referenced an atom that turned out to be very volatile, nobody else cares about it, he's getting a lot of replication messages, or God forbid he's chairman of the sucker, he can say, okay, this one's a loser, and just drop it on the floor. He tells everybody else, all the other atoms, saying, no, I'm not here anymore. You know, go bother somebody else, and drops it on the floor. So nodes can tune themselves. And similarly, they can decide which atoms they want to drop on the floor. I mean, not doing any good locally, we'll get rid of it, with a couple exceptions. If a node knows that it's got the last copy of an atom on the network, maybe you want to keep it in memory just in case somebody might want it. Keep it in memory a little bit longer just in case. Let's put a little bit of altruistic behavior into nodes. But this is a local policy decision. Nobody tells any node what to do. He figures out, he knows how much memory he's been said he can play with. He knows what he's doing locally. He knows how responsive other guys. He does what makes sense for him. I hope Ayn Rand wouldn't approve. Transaction control. Let me go through this quickly. First, a transaction runs on a single SQL node. We can relax that someday, but right now, let's just say the transaction runs on a single SQL node. The concurrency control is record version based, which we talked about earlier, MVCC. Transactions see the results of transactions that were reported committed when and where it starts. This is our first major departure from database theory, and that is a transaction may have committed an Alpha Centauri before we start, but if we don't hear about it, we're going to assume it's concurrent. Not a big leap, but it turns out to be a huge leap. So a transaction sees only those transactions that were reported as committed on the node on which he was running when he started. This is where the magic starts. And that works. Consistency is maintained by the Atom chairman. So if somebody wants to insert into a unique index, they say, I've got this unique value. I send it to the chairman for the index atom. He says, no. You know, here are these other instances, you better check them out. And it turns out, okay, it's not unique. I have to report an error back to my user. Two guys try and update the same record. One sends to the chairman and say, I want to update record 97. The last transaction I saw was 927. Can I do it? And the chairman of you say, yeah, go right ahead and take note of that and make sure nobody else does that until this guy commits. Or he says, well, actually, I've got a transaction 528 who beat you to it. So, you figure out what to do about him and, you know, call me back if you want to do something else. So we get the consistency through the Atom chairman. The Atoms broadcast replication messages to each other on a peer-to-peer basis. And here's the critically important thing that makes everything work. And that is all of the replication messages precede the commit. So if you received a commit on your node, you know that any of the atoms on your node have received the replication. And if you start a transaction, it can see that transaction because you've got all of the updates. There are a couple of funny cases where you get three or four node sequences and we can handle them those and detect those. But basically, you know, the rule is you get all the updates before the commit. When you got the commit, it's time to go. Okay. This is the key theoretical slide. Unless you're coming here to buy stock in Nimbus, if you do, Barry's the one to see. Coming back to our physics theme, NimbusDB is relativistic. First, there is no absolute state in the database. You can only see the database through the context of a transaction. There is no global state for this database. You could only see it through a transaction. Okay. Second, that consistency is only defined in the context of a transaction. You can't say that a database system is consistent because it doesn't have a specific state. A transaction can start up and check all of the rules that were declared for the database and say, yes, this is consistent. Do some stuff, check all the rules again, say it's consistent, commit. And when the commit succeeds, the next guy who starts has to see a consistent database. So you have to enforce all of these rules. But they're not done on an absolute basis. They're done from a transaction context. And this is the direct analogy to the special relativity. And that is, there is no such thing as an absolute reference platform. There are individual reference platforms that obey the laws of physics. They're independent. They see different things of the same phenomenon. For the fourth time, there is no single definitive database state. You've got multiple versions of records. You've got transaction information all over the place. And different nodes will have different subsets of the data. Archive nodes have everything, but even they are any given instant. If you could imagine the concept of a single instant, they're going to be different because of message skew. Not all of them will have received the same messages. They're all going to be a little bit different. So, Dorothy, we're not in Kansas anymore. This database system is not like anything else. I mean, you've got pieces of it spread across potentially a couple continents. You've got a couple dozen machines, archive nodes. Each one is a little bit different. It's taken as a unit through any transaction. It's consistent. Okay, archive nodes improve durability. I think we need to skip through this. the more archive nodes you have, the happier everybody is. I mean, except you have to pay for them. So you put two archive nodes in New York, you put two archive nodes in Tokyo, that gives you redundancy, you put another one under in a bunker under Nebraska in case something happens to both New York and Tokyo, which means somebody's breeding Godzillas, and everybody's happy. The more transaction, more archive nodes, the more capacity you've got. Costs a little bit in overhead because you've got another machine to send a message to, but if one's busy, you can talk to another one. Commits. Transaction is ready to commit. He sends to the archive notes. He broadcasts to all the transaction managers a pre-commit message saying, you know, I'm done. I'm ready to commit. In most cases, there's a mode I'll get to later. An archive node will say, okay, I hereby declare you committed. The reason you do that is you want to know that everything is at least two places before you get the commit. Sending off the message saying I'm committing and having some of the stuff be missing would be very, very distressing. So we let the archive nodes do the final blessing of the commit, and the archive node participates in the replication of everything. So it's guaranteed they will have all of the updates. And if you've got multiple archive nodes, you're going to have multiple copies. Transactional nodes, of course, provide scalability. You plug in more, you get more capacity, more transactions per second, more users, more Facebook pages. Now, any transactional node can, in theory, do anything. They're all equivalent. They all have access to the same atoms from the same archive service, same network. If you're smart and you're having a very large database, you start doing something. We have a connection broker. Or a client talks to a connection broker saying, you know, I want to talk to somebody. This is the database I want to talk to. And here is a connection key, which may be like a customer number. And the connection broker said, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, why don't you go talk to this guy over here? And as long as he routes everybody to the same place, this guy will tend to accumulate the data that are of some interest to this small set of customers that are going in that direction. And you get all of the benefits of sharding, which is a horrible thing to do, but it works, without any of the software overhead of sharding, which is to say you have a machine that just, by the patterns of usage, tends to have the atoms that are needed sitting in memory, and now it's going to go very, very, very fast. It doesn't have to go fetch atoms over the network. If it needs to, it can. But if you do it right, it doesn't. The application programmer doesn't have to worry about it. You don't have to have middleware that knows about partitioning. You don't have to have middleware that knows about two-phase commit. Just by the architecture, transaction nodes tend to request atoms from local nodes. They're the ones who are fast. The ones in Tokyo are slow. So all of your communication tends to be in your data center. Your replication messages, which are asynchronous and batched, are going over your long-haul networks. Eventually, they'll get to the other side, but you don't particularly care because everything you want is local. The other stuff is non-time critical. You want the bandwidth where it's not going to work, but you don't have to pay the latency. So data dynamically and automatically, just by the architecture, trends towards locality and high performance. And here's the little stuff on Nimbus, which I toss in, which is of no theoretical cosmic significance. It has semantic extension. I like to say the shirts are clothes, but they aren't pants. You have a base table of clothes. You have another table with called shirts that extends clothes. You've got a collar size and sleeve length. Anything you store in shirts also shows up in clothes. You also have pants with a waist and an inseam. Those aren't shirts either, but they are clothes. So we've got a semantic model. I've been meaning to do that for about 20 years and finally get around to it. Second, it has unbounded strings. It'll take a varchar, but come on, guys. Strings are variable length. They've been variable length for a long time. Varchar is left over from punch cards, where you had columns 7 through 9, and let's forget it. Punch cards are also yesterday. How many people do not know what an O29 is? It's an IBM key punch. Came out with the 360, handled EBCDIC, as opposed to the O26, which was BCD for the old stuff. That warms my heart. This is just an annoyance. Database systems are sometimes so dumb. Bounded strings, varchar 40 for somebody's last name, which means if you hired a Polish anthropologist, you have to go restructure your database is absurd. Numbers, it takes numbers. It says this is a number. Deal with it. I don't care whether it's a tiny int or a short int or an int or a big int or a very large int or a big int. It's a number. All the metadata is dynamic, so you don't have to take stuff out and redefine it and stick it back in. So, and it does the standard trick that I've been doing for a long, long time is you change the metadata, it changes the format version, new records go in the new version, the old ones stay there. It's a non-entity. Members of a chorus are, of course, platform independent. We wouldn't want to have any platform dependency. I used to use the analogy, you start a company in, on the East Coast, you put it on Intel machines, somehow you lived a bad life, so you got bought by Sun Microsystems, moved to Menlo Park and moved into one of their data centers on Sparks, and then Sun got bought by Oracle, and you pulled your company out and took it, spun it off and took it up to San Francisco and put it on an AMD system. So you've been through 5 or 6 years. You've been through 2 or 3 platform shifts from Intel to Spark and back to AMD. You've been through 5 or 6 major software versions, 2 geographical shifts, and you've never gone for 10 milliseconds without handling queries. I think that's cool. So you could take a running Intel chorus out of Spark, who cares? Software upgrades are rolling. With the database system is really not defined by the database on disk, but the message format. And when you want to introduce, want to upgrade your chorus, you take a machine out, you put the new software on it, he comes in and he says, okay, we're running version 4. I'm version 5, but I'll humor him until the last version 4 goes away. Then poof, everybody starts talking the new protocol and we're done. A non-issue. So the goal is, it's not 24/7, but 24/365. Or more on leap years. I think the idea of a database system that goes up and stays up for 5 or 6 years, outliving the platform and the company that's created it is kind of neat. And I know somebody's going to ask this question, so I'll just take it up right now. I have yet to run into a database talk where somebody didn't get hot and bothered about the cap theorem or the cap conjecture, which is that you can't have the consistent, available, and partition resistant, which is complete nonsense. So we have our ATM network. We've got machines in New York. We've got machines in Tokyo. And you want to ask me, well, what happens if California slides into the ocean and all of the communication lines go through California and they can't talk anymore? Okay, so here is the strategy. This is going to be an option. You don't have to turn it on because you're in a data center. This is a waste of time. We designate certain archive nodes as commit agents. I don't think of them as commit agents. I think of them as canaries, as in canaries in a coal mine. So you define subsets of commit agents called coteries. Hector Garcia Molina gave a talk at DEC a trillion years ago about coteries and how to solve the partition problem. And it was kind of data that stuck with me, and I probably got an opportunity to use it, so I'm really excited. So you have coteries. The rules, coteries are a subset of the commit agents such that there are no two coteries that are disjoint. So you can't have two disjoint coteries, which means that after a network partition event, if you have a partition that contains a full coterie, then it can continue to run. Because if, and this guarantees that there aren't two surviving coteries, two surviving partitions, because if there were, they would have to have a node in common because there aren't any disjoint coteries. So the way commit works in this regime is that before a transaction can be considered committed, it has to be reported to at least one commit agent in every coterie. And that sounds onerous, but it isn't. That's actually, even on a large number of machines, that's a relatively small number of machines. And that means if you have a partition event, no matter what happens, either that transaction will commit durably and consistently on the surviving partition, or it won't. And we should care which, but we don't. I mean, if it hasn't been declared committed anywhere, then it's not committed. If it's been declared committed any place in a surviving coterie, in a surviving partition, then it will be committed, and you will know that the guy got his money for his sushi. And that leads up to the fun part of the evening. So at this point, I'd like to throw things open to questions. This is Ann Harrison, who's also my wife, co-conspirator. She hears better than I do, and she also listens a little bit more carefully to what you're actually asking, and is going to remind me to answer the question that you're asking rather than the question that I want to answer. Anne.
One of the things that you didn't say, I think it's useful, is that a transaction does not need to be on disk to be durable.
Oh. Why didn't you bring this up earlier when we were doing the slides?
Because I couldn't get your attention.
Oh.
And you said not to.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And this, a NIVIS transaction is considered committed if it's at least two places on the network. And we know it's going, everything in it is going to be at least in an archive node and on the node that's running. It's probably going to be a lot of other places too. And we have, you know, there are circumstances in which you have multiple failures. You may have to hunt that stuff down, but it is available. But we know before we're willing to commit it, we know that every update on that exists both in the original node and on at least one archive node. And if we're going to be doing the commit sequence partition resistant algorithm, then it's going to, before it's committed, it's going to have to be on a archive node in every single coterie that's been defined for the system. It doesn't say that if you have massive failure and somebody goes in berserk and with an axe and hits every archive node that your database system is going to survive. It says that we can tell you how many points of failure we can survive. I assume anybody in the right mind is going to have a battery backup on their archive nodes. But still, if you've got multiple archive nodes, you're partition resistant, you're going to have stuff all over. So yeah, it doesn't have to go to disk, and that's a huge performance gain. Because otherwise, and almost all disk-based database systems do this, is that they keep a commit log, they do batch commits, but they have to do a physical disk write, a non-buffered disk write, which goes, you know, from the database process through the operating system to the disk controllers, and unless the disk controllers line, which most of them do, to the oxide. Otherwise, you get a power failure, the stuff is going to disappear. So no, in NIMBUS, it's committed if it's at least two places on the network. Yes. Backup? Oh, that's really cool. There are two ways to do backup. The easiest one is to unplug your archive node. Okay.
The question is, how do you know that that archive node that you just unplugged is consistent?
Oh, it is. Okay. How do you know?
And one of the questions is, what is the consistency of this?
What consistent means in this case is that you can take that archive node, bring it up in a separate chorus with another transaction node and recover every committed transaction that was committed to that database. That's what that means. A smarter way to do it is to take something like ZFS, use that as a file system, where you can take a snapshot, have that give you a virtual snapshot, and you can back it up to anything that you want. The question really becomes for a large database, where are you going to back it up to? I mean, the only things that are really big and cheap are disks. Oh, ZFS. ZFS is a file system that Sun developed for high performance computing. It uses 1 meg blocks, so it's got big stuff, and it's very interesting. It's got enough redundancy that you can take a snapshot, a virtual snapshot of a file system, and back it up. So at the instant you started the snapshot, you're going to see a consistent view of those files, but in fact stuff is still going on. So you can back it up that way. Something that I learned a long time ago, however, is that backups are useless. We're in a 24/7 or a 24/365 world, and you can't afford ever to shut down your company or the world to restore a database system. It's just, you just cannot do that. And nobody does, because you just can't do it. So everyone has moved to systems where replication and failover, where if your node fails, somebody else will pick it up. Somebody else has got a hot copy. Nimbus just takes that idea one step further. So there are ways to do backups, but I dispute the value of a backup. Okay. Yes.
For a simple example where I just want to run a transaction that inserts into a single row into a single table.
Yes.
Could you explain how the node decides what atoms it needs, what atoms where it's going to put this row, what needs to be updated, and then say when a transaction is run and it wants to read that and how it knows which atom has it? Does that make sense?
I think the proper answer to your question is yes, I could.
Oh, be nuts.
And would you?
No. Okay, that's about an 8-hour conversation. Okay, a little bit. Okay, so you've got a database, relational database engine that wants to insert a record. The first thing during the compilation process, it's going to talk to a database record to find out the schema. It's going to take the schema record. It's going to find a table atom. It's going to have its own metadata, so he knows what that looks like. So then he's going to talk to a transaction manager. They start a transaction. He's going to get some sort of handle. Then he's going to tell the table atom, I want to store a record. And the table atom is going to look at it and says, okay, I got to generate a record ID for it. It's going to come up with a number, and that's another process that's interesting that I don't have time to go into. And that says, okay, based on that record number, this is the guy who's going to be handling the insert. It says, put this record someplace and tell me where you put it. And so it's going to end up, there's something's going to happen to the table atom and generating an ID. He's going to go to somebody who's custodian for a set of records, and eventually he's going to put it in the third place. The replication messages start at the bottom and work their way up. There's a technique called careful write where you do updates in order that it's always valid and always consistent. The basic idea, if you're going to write a pointer to something, you write the thing first and then the pointer. So if things go badly, you never have a dangling pointer. So the bottom level guy is going to propagate the actual data. Somebody else is going to say where he put it. This guy's going to say, by the way, I've used up a record ID, and it's going to come back and say it's inserted. So we're going to probably talk you 3 or 4 messages. We make more if you're going through indexes. But they're going to all go out the same packets. But they're only going to go out to the people who want them, who care about it. So if you're doing an insert, you're going to have to know what the indexes are because you want to update those. And those index atoms are going to be changed, and they're going to send out the replication messages. If you're doing a retrieval, you probably, exhaustive retrieval, non-qualified retrieval, you don't care about the indexes. You have no reason to grab them. So you just have what data you need to execute the query on your system. And if you're lucky and stuff gets directed or the database is the active part of the database fits in memory, then you're probably never going to touch another node. At least that's the theory. Okay. How big are the atoms? It came to me in a dream that 50K was the right size. And one of these days, I'm going to hire some really bright kid who's going to tell me why I'm wrong.
The question was, what about tables?
What about tables?
Yeah. How do you constrain a table to 50K?
Oh, you don't constrain a table to 50K. You break into lots of little pieces. And you take your data atoms, you start putting data into it, and when that one gets to be big enough, you say, okay, time to make a new one. So you just create more atoms. I mean, nothing wrong with creating more atoms. There's a little bit of song and dance involved. It's kind of cute. Yes?
I'm thinking about the database data model. I'm talking about the petabyte. I'm bringing that up. It comes to the name of 500 or 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 500
It's easier than you think. there's a system of catalogs that have to know where stuff is. And, they're atoms, so they replicate to each other too. So, and of course you don't have to have all the atoms on the system, all the catalogs on the system, just the ones that you care about.
I feel that data is probably mostly fairly stable.
Yeah. I mean, you've got a large amount of data. You've got a huge amount of data. You've got repetitive data, but broken into to hunks. But most of it's not going to be referenced. There are very few applications that actually go through petadata with data, and the applications that do really have a budget to pay for a lot of memory, and that's what you need. I mean, no matter how you build a database system, if it's going to perform, you want to be able to keep the volatile data in memory. And this is no different. It's a question of how do you organize the data is the question. It was... I missed that.
What it says is it's like the problem of routing tables on the internet. It's just maintaining the routing tables is taking up all computing cycles in the world.
No, I don't think it's that much of a problem. I mean, a hierarchy of catalogs, goes a long way towards solving that. The amount of bookkeeping about the bookkeeping isn't that bad. We'll see. A formative lecture I attended when I was working at CCA in the 70s was, that really stuck with me is that somebody said, that you have memory hierarchies that just naturally occur. And you've got registers, which are very fast, and then you've got main memory. Then you have cache, which was a new thing at that time. You've got cache memory, and then you've got main memory, and then you've got virtual memory, which is also new. And then you've got disks, and you have this pyramid. And the higher you go, the faster and smaller the memory is. And the lower you go, the larger and slower. And he said that the speeds are going to change, the elements and the layers are probably going to change, but the hierarchy is going to be there, and the question is how you use it intelligently. And, up to now, database systems are kind of built on the hierarchy of, we've got registers, and we've got cache, and we've got memory, we've got virtual memory and disks. Well, they missed something, and that is it really should go register, cache, main memory, let's forget about virtual memory, it was a good idea for a while. Network, and then disk. Because your network is a great deal faster than your disk is. And if you've got a large number of nodes, you've got a large number of memory separate around the network, let's use that. So I think that's the long-winded answer. This uses the memory hierarchy the same way we'd have used it before, except we've got another element in it, and that element is the network. But to make advantage of the network, we have to solve this relativity problem. We have to give up on the idea that it has to be serializable for what reason, and find a different way to do consistency so we can take advantage of parallelism and not get nailed by the latency of communication. But you can exploit the network without trying to make it operate like a single machine, which it was not born to be. Okay. Yes? Wait, what was the last part?
Okay. You're a bank.
I'm not a bank.
The auditors come in.
Yeah.
And you say, it's easy. What answer do you want?
It's not quite that simple because you start a transaction, you look at what's in there, and your database system is going to give you back what you put in there. I mean, you can demonstrate that it's just as consistent as any other system. It just doesn't happen to be serializable. And I don't think you'll find an auditor anywhere who even understands the concept of serializable. And if it is, he works for General Mills. There's a joke there, guys.
I think what's missing here is the concept that you do an audit at one instant in time. If you did the audit 2 seconds earlier, you get one answer. If you did it 2 seconds later, you get another answer. In this system of nodes, if you ask node A, it's got things effectively at one time. If you ask node B, it's got things effectively at a very slightly different time. So you do the audit, you get a consistent answer. But if you were able to do the audit absolutely synchronously on two different nodes, you might get two slightly different answers. As if they were at a distance from each other, and it took a while for the...
Or if you started two of these audits back to back on the same machine, 1 second apart, you're going to get a different answer. Unless you quiesce the system, the transaction is going to be internally consistent, but it's not going to reflect what the data looks like at the end of the transaction. Because if some poor sucker withdraws money for his sushi, what the audit shows is not going to be what's in the account. And this is kind of the basic idea of everything, and that is that a transaction starts, you can see a stable view of the data, but the results are going to be consistent with when it started, not when it finished.
The question is, do the nodes diverge over time, or do the messages eventually all come?
Okay.
The nodes
do not diverge, and dare I say that if you were to stop all updates, and I hate to use this phrase, it's useful, but it's going to give the wrong idea, it is what is referred to as eventually consistent. They will converge, all nodes will converge, all archive nodes will converge to the same content, all transactional nodes will be exact replicas on an atom-by-atom basis of what's in the archive node. Now, the reason I don't want to say that it's eventually consistent is that eventually consistent carries a lot of baggage with it, because eventually consistent has come to mean not consistent. So, yes, from a physical layer, it is eventually consistent if you were to stop all updates. The magic sauce is being able to use MVCC on top of it to give transactions complete consistency while the stuff is changing underneath. Okay.
I just want to follow this up. Because you guys are philosophical, but I think the word that the absence of crazy relativity is simultaneous.
It's a concept I don't recognize. It's not a networking term. You get simultaneity with serializability.
You can take two different audits, two different places, and get two different results. That may be, in the scheme of things, okay. But I think you're going to have a hard time selling that to regulatory types.
This is no different from any other database system with that regard, and that is, if you produce a report, no matter how comprehensive, and allow updates to happen, if you repeat that report, you're going to get a different answer. It's a different transaction. If you want to shut down all of the updates, you can get the same thing twice. Okay. Okay. Probably not. I don't. Okay. I came up with MVCC and RDBLON at DEC. Faxes are now gone. So is that product. Alon Cutler went off and did NT instead of continuing with Fax Alon. But Interbase, you know, it's now a 25-year-old database system, is MVCC, and it's perfectly accepted. It's, you know, it's was the leading bootleg database system in Brazil. It was the leading until it went open source and became legitimate, and it was the leading bootleg database system in Russia for a while. And of course, it's open source there too, I guess, if they have anything that's open. Okay, question. I'll get to you guys. Okay, this is the two guys. Okay. You've got a bank account with $1,500. You've got 50 friends with stopwatches or GPSs, and they all want to withdraw the last $1,500, and you have a nice multiplier there if you pull it off. Okay, here's what happens. The first guy does the withdrawal. He may only be a nanosecond ahead of the next guy, but somebody's got to be first. SQL engine says, okay, I want to update this record. One of the record atoms is going to say, okay, I want to update this record. He sends a message off to the chairman for that band of records saying, I want to do this update. And the most recent version I see was created by transaction 528. And the chairman says, looks good to me. Go ahead. So he does his tentative update, and of course he sends out his replication messages, which he sends out long before the commit. Now the next guy comes along. He just came along, you know, a nanosecond later, a millisecond later, who cares. So, you know, his update goes down, and he's looking at the same record, and he sends a message to the chairman saying, I want to update this record. The last one I saw was transaction 528, which is the same one. The other guy says, well, sorry. 720 beat you to it, so you wait for 720 and then try again. So he returns an update conflict back to his youth, to the ATM machine, who does a restart. He comes back and says, okay, sorry, that account's empty. And if everybody's doing their job, the chairman is in New York, the ATM is in New York, the transactional node is in New York, and nobody in Tokyo cares about this at all. God, every time I answer one, there are more. Okay. Up in the corner, you're getting ready to die. I gotta get you out of your misery. Yes. Well, the archive node's got everything. For this version, I'm answering that question yes. There's no theoretical reason that you couldn't partition the archive nodes to handle a subset of atoms, but I don't want to do that until I know there's a goddamn good reason to do so. And it's not going to be a theoretical reason, it's going to be a practical reason. So, yes, every archive atom, when you plug a brand new archive node in, before he comes up, he's going to synchronize with other archives, which means you can sit there and be essentially useless, sucking down a huge amount of data. So the smart thing to do if you're going to create a new archive node is to use CFS, copy your data to the other new archive node. He will then come up thinking that he used to be part of the chorus. When he comes up, he will synchronize with another archive node, but it's only going to be 15 minutes old, and it won't take very long. Similarly, if you have an archive node that's sitting there with everything on it, he goes down for some reason, when he comes back up, he's going to talk to another archive node and say, well, when did you write these atoms the last time, and decide what he needs to do to bring himself up to rev. And that's going to be a relatively short process. And then when he's done, he changes his mode from a synchronizing archive node to an functioning archive node. Until then, nobody's going to ask him for anything. He's still going to participate in replication for the stuff that he does have.
What he's saying is that the archive node doesn't know anything about the semantics of atoms.
Oh, no. Oh, Well, actually, the archive node is running the same software as everything else, but in fact, he doesn't take note of any semantics of atoms. He doesn't care. I mean, they're atoms. He says, serialize thyself. There's a method on it that does it. He doesn't know what it is. He doesn't care. Okay, the guy behind you, him, yeah, the one in the corner. You get that?
What he says is, in what circumstances do you not have your transactions actually serialized?
Oh, that's a very good question. Had a good friend at DAC named Bill Noyce, and when the Saturday they invented MVCC, I thought it was serializable. Actually, it is degree three consistent with Gray's rules. It's degree three consistent, and it's also serializable as defined by the SQL standard. It just doesn't happen to be serializable. Here is the example. You have one table with one column, which is a number. You've got one transaction type. What this transaction does is it counts the number of records in the table and stores a record with that number. If it's serializable, there's a 0, a 1, a 2, a 3, and a 4. If it's not serializable, you can have 2 zeros, no 1s, and 2 2s. And that's the real test. So it's a very simple thing, and MVCC is not serializable by that test. It is serialized, like I said. It is degree 3 consistent, and you can still find computer science textbooks that say that degree 3 consistency is equivalent to serializable. Gray finally admitted that it wasn't. But it does meet the SQL standard for serializable, which is more of a reflection of the SQL standard than anything else. Okay. Who has any? Yes.
So I think we're all fine with the theory. How about this in practice? Where are you in terms of how the product gets data or...
Okay. I am in room 315 of building 51, giving a talk and not coding. where I am right now, it basically works. It's not completely debugged, but it basically works enough that I can measure it. It'll run TPCC benchmarks 60-70% of the time. And now moving it off into product development. The technology development, I am now convinced the theoretical problems are all solved. And most of them have been implemented. It's a debugging question. But let me say, this is the hardest goddamn thing I've ever had to debug in my entire life. Because when you're running with five machines, running asynchronously, passing messages, leaving no trails, it's breathtaking. Oh, yes.
There will be a limit of access to what we call an alpha release, probably within something like 6 to 8 weeks.
So it is way beyond theory. The thing actually. Okay. Yes. Cloud computing.
Is it general fit to the cloud?
Yeah. General. Right now, the dominant mode of cloud computing is EC2, virtual machines instantiated in a cloud. We've got applications that are sitting there. They want to talk to a database system. And the promise of the cloud is that if you need more capacity, you can fire up more systems. You go point and click and, give me five more. So you've got five applications that are serving an increasing number of users who are happy with the system, and ultimately they all go back to a database system. And the database system is a problem, and it's got a whole bunch of problems. I mean, one is it doesn't work very well in virtual machines because when you shut them down, their local memory goes away, which is really inconvenient for a database system. Another is that current database systems take a lot of care in feeding. You take the cheapest one on the block, which is MySQL, and you look at it, and it's got approximately 250 tuning parameters that you have to figure out and set if you're going to do anything real with it. And it takes a lot of care in feeding. Having a multi-tenant database system for a cloud provider to say, we will give you a scalable database system, and internally they say, okay, we can run a very large number of instances of database, of independent databases on the same set of computers managed by a very small number of people is very attractive. It's kind of a win-win-win-win right across the board, particularly if they buy our software. Yes? The question was, what applications are not good? I can say, tell you right now that if you're going to do geographical distribution, the very low latency requirements are really probably not what you want, because if you're going to guarantee survivability after a partition event, you've got to make sure the stuff actually gets to Tokyo before it can say it's committed, and Google will tell you if you can't get an answer in half a second, they're going to get bored. It's scary, the degree of our attention span, but Google's measured it down to a fraction of a second, and unfortunately, they're right. So if you're going to be running something like that, you're really going to run out of a data center. You don't want to be doing long lines. There's some things, ATM, who cares? You know he's going to notice half a second as long as they get their sushi at the end of the day. Data warehousing probably doesn't need this. From a business perspective, I'm really not very interested in data warehousing. I don't see it's a very hard problem. Besides, there are an awful lot of people chasing that market. Transactions are necessary when three conditions are met. And that is, you have to have data that's shared, you need to have data that's volatile, and you need to have data that's valuable. If you don't have all three, you don't need this. And you can go to something that might even a little bit work better. So take Facebook, for example. The data is volatile, it's shared, and it's not the least bit valuable. And they don't care if they lose it. They'd rather not. But they don't care. And so what they do is they have 5,000 MySQL servers, and each one is serving memcached local servers, and they've got stuff cached out of the wazoo every place. And, if they miss an update, they'll get it sooner or later. And, nobody's going to complain or demand their money back because it's free. So if it's not shared, not valuable, and not volatile, if it's not volatile, you pass it around in DVDs and forget about it. And if it's not shared, you can use Simple DB or Bigtable, because it'll give perfectly good answers. I mean, those things are designed to model a shopping cart, and they do very good at modeling the shopping cart. They've got basically a big fat object with very complex internals. They can put everything about the transaction in one row, and eventually it persists, and that works fine for shopping cart. But you look at these organizations, what they use internally for their own stuff. Google uses InnoDB on MySQL, which they've heavily modified, using technology they took out of Falcon, I might complain about, to manage their ad business. So SimpleDB is good enough for their customers, but when it comes down to managing their own data, particularly their own money, they really want consistent ACID transactions. So valuable, shared, volatile, valuable, needs this. Things that don't have that. Data warehousing. Nobody's...
On the different workloads issue, it's true that the product is not targeted at warehouse loads. It's not very commercially interesting to us, but it's competitive reasons, if nothing else. But it is interesting with mixed loads that we can do things that are unusual.
This is true. What you can do is you can dedicate a node to doing a big BI calculation. It's going to sit off there. It's not going to bother anybody else. It may suck out an archive to a dry of bandwidth, but it's going to sit there on a live database and work quite nicely. But I don't want to get into that market. Okay. Yes. Am I being fair on questions? I mean, there's okay. Okay. That was your question. Yes. Where chairman is not sex indicating. I don't haven't determined whether atoms are male, female, or what. Okay.
Is it associated with an atom?
Is it with an atom? Every atom that's resident in memory has a chairman.
So a transaction could have multiple chairmen.
No, a transaction actually isn't an atom. Absolutely. You can reference a lot of tables in your transaction. There's no question about that. And yes, you can be, most update operations will involve a round trip to a chairman for consistency. An insert will not, but an update or a delete will, because you have to maintain consistency. There's no free lunch. I don't know how to do consistency without communication. Which I think kind of Brewer in his cap theorem is kind of proved. If you can't communicate, you can't be consistent. The question is, what can we do to minimize the communication? And so, yeah, every update, every SQL update, every SQL delete is going to require a trip to the chairman unless you happen to be the chairman. Now, if it happens that you're the only guy who cares about this particular atom, because we distributed our connections based on a connection key, then it's highly likely that every node is going to be the chairman of most of the nodes, most of the atoms that has resident and doesn't have to talk to anybody for those. Yeah, I mean, if you're the chairman, you make the rules, buddy.
It's also true that communication with the chairman is asynchronous.
The communication with the chairman is asynchronous, meaning this guy sends a message, it goes into the queue, it gets sent out. He's probably going to give it a little nudge, so maybe it'll go faster.
Maybe it is. So the atom is the thing that actually needs to store the data. It's one of the table atoms or the data atoms for the data.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm updating 100 rows in a table, I'm going to potentially be reading 7 different atoms.
Yep.
All of these atoms do not have the same chairman.
That's right. They need not have the same chairman that's distributed around the network. And
so the question in that case, who is doing the update? Is it one node or multiple nodes?
Oh. Okay. What's actually going to happen is if you do an update and you're not the chairman, then you're going to ask the chairman, is it okay? Can they message back saying, that's okay. Go ahead. And then you're going to queue a message to everybody else who's got an atom saying, I just did this update. And when they get to it, when it shows up there, it gets through the message queue and over the network down, they're going to apply it. So, in fact, your update is going to start propagating around the network to all of the other instances of that atom as soon as you've done the update. But it's going to take a while for it to percolate around. But that's okay.
But you do the update on the data atom on your node.
You do the update on the data atom on your node. That atom takes it upon itself to tell his peers, I've just processed this update.
But a bunch of chairmen have given you the permission to update.
Yes. Yes.
So there's some sort of meeting with chairman at some point.
Yeah. Okay. I don't. Nope. Back row. It's possible that there could be. I haven't run into one yet, and there's no problem undoing it.
Referential integrity.
haven't implemented that, so I'm going to have to think on my feet. I mean, I've thought through the problem. Okay, if you are going to be, if you're deleting a parent record, no, let's see, what's a good example? Okay. Most of that will happen to the index atoms, you're absolutely right. But if somebody is doing an insert of a record that references a primary key in another table, he's going to check in with the chairman of the primary key and say, I'm depending on you. You know, don't let anybody delete it without letting me know or letting him know that I depend on it. So the chairman will register, you know, that and will guarantee that it will be consistent. It's not just a yes-no. It's if you say yes, the chairman is obligated to do whatever is necessary to enforce that consistency, which means telling other people who might want to change it that they can't. Or they have to wait for this other transaction to complete, and then they can retry the operation, and maybe it'll be better next time. Okay, yes.
My concern is how many message network messages might get involved to do one different message.
I prefer that you not quote me, but what we're measuring running TPCC is that we're getting about 17 messages per packet. Now, that's a different question, and the answer is that a basic insert operation is going to be about 3 messages more if there are indexes. You know, so one more message for every index that needs to be updated. If it's a unique index, you're going to have to do a little bit more. So there's a fair number of messages that show up. The messages are very, very short, which is another reason that it's advantageous to batch the little suckers. But yeah, I mean, there's messaging that goes on, and messaging is very important. The measurements that I have done, I don't want to go into numbers. Okay.
These are not all sent out. Every time you think of something that you want to say to somebody, you send out a message instantly. They're batched.
Most messages are just put into the queue. If somebody's going to be waiting for a response, like he wants a response from the chairman, he will say, you know, flush the queue. You know, send this batch on its way.
The
what? There are two problems in all database implementations. One of them is what database systems are intended to do, which is to manage shared volatile data. The other one is to balance throughput versus latency. And that is a fine art. And I don't think those questions can be answered in the absolute or by theory. I think those only can be measured by practice because it has a huge effect. The characteristics of your communication has a huge effect on it. If there's a lot of CPU involved in shipping a packet out, then you really want to batch stuff up because you're going to be spending a lot of CPU, whether it's 10 bytes or 1,000 bytes. If you've got a very smart network controller that you basically say address, length, destination, squirt, then you're probably better off sending tiny little packets because nobody cares. There's no way to answer the question in the absolute. It depends on the characteristics of the machine. So what I've done is basically taken the philosophy is, in general, you queue something to be sent, If you're waiting for a reply, give it a nudge, you know, force it out. And enough stuff gets forced out that, that it doesn't seem to stagnate. And of course, ping messages come around every once in a while and they kick stuff out anyway. So it's not like stuff are going to sit there and stagnate. But by and large, the replication to archive nodes is really not time critical. If you're not a member of a coterie, like you're the guy who's sitting under Nebraska, it really doesn't make much difference how long it takes to get there. This is only there for disaster anyway, and it's going to get there. So it's the stuff that's being accessed locally, yeah, that matters. Who have I neglected? Now, you've been... Ah, yes. Okay, got that?
The question is, if you have the same transaction, meaning the same set of operations,
yep.
And you run it on two nodes at the same time,
yep.
Could it get different answers?
Of course. Absolutely. You ask for your balance. You've got three people, each at an ATM, and two of them do an account balance, and one of them does a withdrawal. You can get different answers, even if you're on the same system. I mean, unless you can stop updates, you can't guarantee that if you ask the same question, you're going to get the same answer. That precludes getting the right answer. If the data changes, you're going to get a different answer.
Well, there is no same point in time. The question was, at the same point in time, can you get a different answer?
That's right. The question is flawed. There is no same point in
time. There's no point set point. And each one is starting a transaction. Each transaction is seeing a view of the data that is consistent with what it looks like at the picosecond that it starts, but they may have different views. Because they're not going to start at precisely the same time. If they overlap, they're not going to see each other. And if they're on different nodes, they may not even overlap and still not see each other.
Sorry, if they overlap, they're not going to see each other. Are you going to do that? Because you said that it's modulo propagation time.
Yeah.
So I can have two transactions.
It's propagation of the commit message. If I haven't gotten the commit message, I'm not going to see that transaction. And the fact that it's committed someplace else, and I haven't heard about it, as far as I'm concerned, is concurrent.
In other words, the sequencing happens with the chairman of that.
Oh, for this, it doesn't even involve a chairman. Let me put it this way. It is not possible to start two identical transactions. There is no logical or physical way that you can say that two transactions, even from the same machine, even if they're created on different threads, you know, that start out two processors in absolute lockstep, that they will see the same state of the database. Okay.
If you're looking at the commit state, it should be the same regardless.
If you did the same thing, she said consistent.
That's right. It should be consistent regardless of where.
I don't.
Okay. Can someone else try?
Is somebody else try translation?
Two different committed transactions will have consistent data. That's the concept of consistent.
Okay. If you start two transactions on the same machine back to back without an intervening commit, they will see identical state. Maybe that's what you're looking for. If they collide, one of them's going to lose. But yes, they will, unless there's an intervening commit, they will see the same thing. If they start at the quote same instant, which is unknowable on different nodes, and they have, those two nodes had received the same commit messages, which is likely but not guaranteed, they will also see the same state. But if for some reason a commit had reached one and not the other, they will could see different states. Each will be a consistent state. Each one will be consistent with the declared consistency constraints on the database. But you know, if they try and collide, they won't. Both of them won't succeed. Okay. Yes.
Why did you say that when an archive node is awakened, that it scans all the atoms, that it asks for updates on all the atoms?
If you plug a Virgin archive node into a Chorus, before it's going to be effective, it is going to have to acquire everything in the database system. And if you happen to have a petabyte out there, that's going to be painful, and that's not the way I would recommend that you do it. The smart way to introduce an archive node is to clone the archive from an existing archive node.
Oh,
he goes down and comes down up. He keeps track of when he wrote stuff last. I refer to this as last rites. And he asks on another archive node, when did you write your guys? And he compares them and figures out, this one's okay, this one I need to get, this one's iffy, I better get it too. So then it's a question of catching up rather than sucking everything over.
So it wouldn't be good enough just to update from the traffic on the network that comes to it?
The problem is that no other node is going to know whether he has a current copy of a given atom or not. He may know, but I think having a transaction node say, I need this atom, can you get it to me? And he says, well, not exactly. It's probably not a good way to run things. So, I decided, and maybe I'll change my mind, that until he's completely synchronized, he's not in the archive node business. He is getting replication messages for stuff that he has, but he's mostly sucking up the disk bandwidth for another archive node, which he can spread around the chorus if he wants, but he's sucking down, old atoms, more recently atoms than what he's got to get himself synchronized. Yes. From which computer?
Interest has to be computed.
Interest.
Talking about time.
Don't know. Okay.
You said earlier that at least for the time being, the archive node will.
Yes. Okay.
Whether it's not like an
idea. I'll take that as flattering. The only reason that I would agree to partition archive nodes right now is so I don't have to argue about it anymore. I'm embarrassed to say I do that from time to time. I mean, that's part of the reason I do SQL. I don't like SQL. I mean, nobody likes SQL. I mean, for God's sakes. You submitted SQL as a term paper for a sophomore course in computer science. You flunk. But I like to defer questions I don't have to answer. And I can just say that it's not architectural. As long as a transactional atom can determine which archive nodes are going to have an atom, the fact that they're partitioned is of no interest whatsoever to anybody. So, you know, it's something you can change your mind in a blink of an eye or a software version. So I don't see it as an architectural question. Oh, good. Thank you.
We have time for just one or two more questions. And then
could we do zero or one?
Dinner in about 10 minutes. So anyone who wants to continue the discussion informally is welcome to join us.
And I'll take two more questions, but you guys have been an absolutely fabulous audience. I mean, a speaker doesn't want anything more than to have people clamoring to ask questions. Okay, yes.
How is the new chairman decided if the chairman that was last known can't be reached in a network failure?
Deterministically. Think about it. It'll be obvious. But I'll leave it as an exercise. It's not hard. And it's computationally free. Okay. Okay. Somebody else pick. I don't want to pick the last answer. And you pick somebody. Yes. Is what? No.
How does the new one know what the old one is giving out for a commit? The new one says, hey, you can do the transaction. And before he gets to tell anyone else, he dies. His node goes away. How does the new chairman know that someone from old, they got the data?
Your question three, where two were permitted.
Thank you.